Special thanks to Log10 Pilot Logbook for supporting the Pilot Base podcast. Log10 is the leading logbook on iPhone, iPad, Watch and Mac for over 100,000 pilots worldwide. And I'm super excited to report that Pilot Base has negotiated an extended 3-month free trial for all listeners. Just visit Coradyne.com/Pilot Base free trial. That's Coradyne.com/Pilot Base free trial. And for those needing data imported into Log10, the team can do that for you. Get started at Coradyne.com/Pilot Base free trial.
Hello, and welcome to the Pilot Base podcast. I'm Ben, and I've been a pilot for over a decade.
And I'm Dave, categorically not a pilot.
Every Monday, we'll be chatting to both pilots and non-pilots with amazing aviation stories from all around the world. You can find all episodes of the Pilot Base podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you're hearing, subscribe to our channel and leave us a review.
In this episode, we meet Mike Burgess. Now, Mike was a latecomer to aviation. He had a great job, a career working offshore, a forces background, a family, a pretty good normal life. But he decided he wanted to be a pilot. And like so many, his journey was a long and sometimes unrequited labour of love. Fast forward, and now he works for Loganair, and the pride and the warmth with which he talks about being a pilot is amazing. Future pilots, potential aviators, listen to this and follow the dream. Everyone else, sit back and enjoy. This is Mike Burgess. Mike Burgess, welcome to Pilot Base. I say welcome to Pilot Base. It's very much an ethereal non-entity at the moment because Ben's in his house, I'm in my house, and you're in your house. Where in the world are you?
I'm up in Keith, which is in Banffshire. So if you can envisage Aberdeen and Inverness on the map, I'm pretty much halfway between the two of them up the main trunk road.
A beautiful part of the world, actually. I've spent some time there, although I am surprised that you get enough signal to join us on a Zoom call, because it was pretty dead when I was there.
Yeah, our outside toilets now, I've just started getting heat in them in as well.
Are you well? How's life treating you at the moment?
Yeah, I'm not too well at all, thanks. Bit of downtime at the minute, not really doing much work, but generally, yeah, health's good. I'm well fed, as I am most days, but yeah.
What about you, Ben? You're looking a bit slim. Are you eating well?
Oh, I'm eating very well, thank you. I think it's the medication I'm on. Just had a knee operation, so using that to slim down. Or I think it's actually the complete opposite that's happening.
Oh, I was going to say, if I sat on my backside because of a knee operation, I would use that as an excuse to reach for the chocolate oranges.
Try my best not to.
So you two know each other from a little while ago, yes? How did you guys meet?
So for myself, it was eventually I took the plunge to do the pilot training. The school that I selected to use a company in Bristol called Bristol Aviation, and it just so happened that Ben had used the same company. And it was, for me, it was day one, day two down in South Africa, a place called Port Alfred on the Eastern Cape. And that's where we were going down to do our training. Ben had already been there a few weeks. And it was in the lounge of Dublin Block in the 43rd Air School in Port Alfred that we met in April 2009, so a few years ago.
If those walls could talk, eh?
Feels like a distant memory now.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons why I'm really keen to get to know you today, Mike, is because your journey has been, well, what words would you use? Unorthodox?
Yeah. Long, arduous, frustrating at times, but essentially in the end, right, well, at the minute, exciting. You know, it's the latter part of it's been very exciting, but obviously the first part of it was, frustrating, I think would be the best word to use.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, knowing Dave all this time, knowing Michael this time, there's been a lot of persistence to get to the point you're currently at.
I am finding the more pilots we speak to, the more persistence is perhaps the most important trait that you all need to get into this game. So let's go back to life before piloting then, because piloting absolutely wasn't your first career, was it? What did you do to begin with to make ends meet?
No, it wasn't. So for me, from quite a young age, I'd always kind of enjoyed tinkering with a bike and things. And around about the age of 14, maybe, we had all the careers, the military careers guys come into the school. And I was sold on the RAF, the Air Force. So essentially, the earliest you could apply was 15 years and 9 months. On that very day, I was in the careers office in Aberdeen, got the paperwork, had it signed. Parents had to sign it to give me the go-ahead to apply. And that was me. I did all the interviewing, testing, medical. And from 2 months after my 16th birthday, I was down doing basic training. So that was airframe engineering. So essentially, you did the basic training. And from there, you were then posted to wherever it might be. For me, it was the famous Dambuster Squadron, which was quite a journey. It was I was only there for about 19 months before I went back to do further training. But that was working on Tornado fast jet aircraft. So the essentially the mechanical maintenance, repair, servicing of those aircraft. And again, did some more training, ended up back at RAF Lossiemouth again. Just quite local to where I was from. And yeah, 7 years I did that for. And as funny as it sounds, people say, why didn't you fly when you're in the RAF? So there was always that, being on the line, flight line, you see an aircraft off, you see it take off, you see them coming in and land. There was always that pie in the sky thing of, oh, you know, it'd be nice to be a pilot one day, but it was never really a serious consideration. And then I came out of the RAF and I got a flying lesson just as like a flight experience for Christmas 1 year. And the instructor at the time said, you know, you've taken to this quite well. Have you ever considered doing it? And kind of from there, it was like, it was a bit more of a seed had been planted. But from that point, I didn't go straight to the flight training. I went offshore, worked in the oil and gas industry, which is quite a popular thing to do up in this neck of the woods as well. And did that for a few years. Met my wife, who took me to Northern Ireland. And when I was over in Northern Ireland, I was project managing over there in a company for Caterpillar, who do power generation. Mm. I'd got in touch with a friend who I used to work in the RAF with, who was down in Dublin, and he'd actually been going through the aptitude side of it. And the companies were always trying to sell you places in training, and they would look at you and, you know, to invite you along to these aptitude tests and say, oh, you're great, you'd be really good at this. By the way, do you want a place? It's going to cost you X amount. So I kind of went down that route, place in Dublin, and it actually turned out, cut a long story short, in the end, the place in Dublin who I went to at the very first part was a sister company of Bristol Aviation, who I ended up with in the end. So from leaving school at 16 and joining the Air Force, it was, 9 years later, before I actually took that first step of getting into the aircraft and doing that very first lesson down in South Africa.
So with that first lesson, when the instructor said to you, you've taken to this quite naturally, have you ever given it a go? I mean, I know hindsight's a wonderful thing, but did any part of you think, I wish I'd pursued this more when I had those aircraft almost at my disposal in the RAF?
100%.
Just to rub it in, Dave.
And the annoying thing is, as well, in the forces, in the military, you've got these basically learning credits that the military or they're paying you to go and do courses. And one of the things I did, which kind of helped me in my, you know, when I pursued the offshore industry, was I did a day release course in mechatronics and HNC. And that was paid for by, well, 80% of it anyway was paid for by the RAF. More importantly, I got a day off work every week. And, you know, and looking at that, even after I came out of the Air Force, I think I had up to 10 years to use these credits, of which could have been used towards flight training. And I never knew that until it was too late. So, you know, there could have been $6,000 of pilot training there over the space of 2 years, which, again, looking at hindsight, could have been done, but it wouldn't have been the journey that it's been. So, and I don't know if the satisfaction would have been the same if it had happened.
And it sounds like, from what you've said, it wasn't like an immediate point where it was like, right, I want to be a pilot. It was kind of a gradual build-up, right? Working in the RAF a little bit and then having a taste of flight and working up your plans.
The amount of people we've met through my career now, but even through the flight training, and it's like, when I was three, I told my dad I wanted to be a pilot, and the bug, it's always been there. And it certainly wasn't like that with me, you know. And equally, I've met people who've kind of had been similar to myself, who've come to aviation a little bit later through maybe not essentially being interested in at the start, and something's kind of put them on. But yeah, like you say, it was being in the Air Force. It was never a real consideration that I could, that I would be a pilot. And I suppose part of that was down to the stigma that's attached to it being, you know, it's a rich boys club that, you know, it's something that without the money, without the investment, there wasn't really that many cadetships either where you could essentially get it paid for you. And again, like I say, growing up, it's one of those things where you think they're paid loads of money, and when you get paid loads of money, it's because you're super smart or something. And don't get me wrong, I'm not, you know, I wouldn't say I'm the bluntest pencil in the pencil case, but you know, there needs to be that element of education as well, you know. So.
And also that level of self-belief. You mentioned it there, like the rich boys club. There does seem, particularly in the UK, to be that echelon of people who are like, well, yeah, I can absolutely be a pilot, or I can absolutely be a Formula One driver, or I don't know, a professional golfer, or any of these things that just seem like normal people can't achieve them. And I think it just takes some people a little bit longer to realize they can. And it took you until your mid-20s, whereas it might take somebody else until their 30s, or somebody else, as you say, might just mention it to their parents in passing at 6 years of age, I can be a pilot. But you arrived at that journey in your own time, or the destination in your own time. And when you got there was no doubt that it was the right thing.
Oh, 100%. From taking that first step, like you say, in hindsight, I wish I'd done it earlier, because the satisfaction now of, I say going to work, work's maybe the right word, but it's not a job. You know, there's not a single day I go to play with my big shiny toy that I feel it's a job. It's nice to be paid for doing it, of course. But yeah, it's just that realization that, again, it's some people's dreams, and some people get their dreams a little bit earlier on in life. Mine came just that little bit later on, you know.
Do you think because of the work you've done in the past in the forces, and then that offshore work, which, you know, it's well remunerated, but it is difficult. You do spend a lot of time away from friends and loved ones. Do you think having those previous jobs has given you a greater appreciation of what you get to do now?
Definitely. The offshore side of it. I started in the North Sea, so I was doing 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time, home for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, depending on what it was. And then a couple of years after doing that, I ended up in a job in the Middle East. And the money was good. You know, it was it gave us a kind of nice lifestyle. You know, we didn't really need to go without anything. But it was anywhere up to 4 or 5.5 weeks away at a time. And the same, you're getting that when you came home. But what you find is when you're away that long, and, you know, you're earning the money, and you're not really spending money when you're away, so you can come back and you can enjoy that better lifestyle. But when you're coming back, having been away for 4 or 5 weeks, it's then taking you a week or two to kind of get into the routine of wife and kids. You know, there's certain things, especially, you know, we had our youngest child when I was working offshore. So I was fortunate that I was home for the first few weeks, but even just that first 2 weeks away and coming back, the amount you missed, and then the certain changes in routine that Vicky, my wife, had put into place, and having to kind of get onto that. It's not just a case of getting 5 weeks at home. You know, that 5 weeks at home, there's a little bit of time that takes you to adapt as well. So getting home every night now, very occasionally you've got the overnight stays, but, you know, the essentially, it's a job where I'm home every night, and, you know, you definitely appreciate that, you know, that side of things.
With regards to having kids, How difficult was it? Well, did it ever come into your consideration that having that time off work and having to retrain and all the money that it takes to retrain whilst you've got the family to feed, did that ever sort of leave any doubts as to whether you were doing the right thing when you were training to be a pilot?
So at the start of the training, the way that the program worked, it was supposed to be, it was around a 6-month stint in South Africa. And the way that they sold, you know, the way that the training company sold that to you, they said that there probably wouldn't be a chance to get home in that time. So we already had our eldest at the time. She was probably 5, I think. So that was a really difficult conversation. You know, I was giving up work, sold a car. My wife was going to be at home and the child on her own. She was a nurse. So it's not like she had a high-flying, high-income job either. So that decision was taken, and it was only because of the support of Vicky, my wife, that the decision was made to go. If she showed any kind of hesitation that she didn't think it was a good idea, or that she didn't, and I wouldn't say cope, because, well, Ben knows that she's a pretty strong lady, and she doesn't need, she wouldn't need me to be there if she didn't think that, you know, but yeah, definitely. It was definitely a consideration. And Ben, I'll tell you, a lot of the people that we met in South Africa, I can't even think of any offhand of any of those that had kids. A lot of them were young, single guys, girls, whatever. And it was a massive adventure for them. And while it was also a massive adventure for me, there was always that worry about, you know, is everything all right at home? And we had regular contact. It was difficult, especially down there at the start, because the internet was awful. So trying to keep in touch on a daily basis, trying to do the Skype calling, or, you know, that was quite hard going. But, yeah, there was definitely that consideration there. Am I doing the right thing? Or and again, it was looking at the longer picture. You know, it was essentially 6-9 months to set up for, you know, what was ahead of us from there.
It's quite funny, actually, because in South Africa, the expats, so there's a few British and Irish guys that going down there through this course, and they tended to be, I mean, it was only probably 5 years older on average than the South Africans, but that age gap made such a difference. So The vast majority of the South African locals had come straight out of high school, so they were 18, 19 years old. Whereas we were, well, I was early 20s. Mike was, how old were you, Mike? 27 at the time?
26, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, we weren't old by any means, but just that little age gap meant we had very different mindsets about how we got on down there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got through flight school, and surely then it's all plain sailing. You get a job, you become a pilot, the rest is history?
Yep. That's exactly how it worked. for some of us, for some guys, yeah.
I half knew the answer to that question. So expectation versus reality then. You passed with literally flying colours. What then?
Yeah, expectation versus reality, chalk and cheese. You know, the way, I suppose, the industry was, I think it was on its upturn by then as well. So it wasn't like there wasn't really recruitment going on. I've been in a position where I've been searching for jobs before, but I've never been in a position where I've not had a job and been searching. You know, so when I transitioned from the Air Force to offshore was booming. I applied for jobs. I left a job, went into a job. This was very different. You know, I think the pressure was on, you know, the desperation was there. But I was just engulfed in spending, you know, hours and hours trawling the internet, trawling different sites, sending emails, sending CVs. And you get to that point of frustration where you don't even get an acknowledgement. If you get an acknowledgement, you don't get a thanks, but no thanks. And in the first year, I suppose the first year was my bar, the year when I got the job 9 years later. The first year was probably most successful because I got an interview with Cathay Pacific in London, which would have been based in Hong Kong. So again, that was going to be if I got offered, it was going to be a very difficult conversation, which obviously we'd already had, but without the reality of maybe something happening. I also got assessments and interview stage with, it was like a pre-interview and then an assessment stage with Lufthansa, but it was the Lufthansa Italia side of things. And I don't know what they're looking for. Astronauts, I think. Again, I've spoken to Ben about this. The assessment, and again, they're looking for the cream of the crop, so you can obviously pass these tests, but for me, that was very much a case of, you know, they want their 1% or their 2% of the crop, and for me that wasn't the case. Flying, the kind of aptitude of flying, I worked hard at to master it, to pass, first series passes. Some people get in a plane and it's absolutely natural to them. They, you know, everything is done exactly as it should be when it should be. Whereas that wasn't the case for me. So somewhere like Lufthansa, although it was nice to get the assessment, there was an element of realization that, yeah, it was a good experience, but the expectation of getting something was probably not there. And then it all goes quiet, you know, so you're firing CVs, you try and keep, you know, you're looking at all these websites. One of them was one called PeepRune, and it's just full of so much negativity that you can have to take yourself away from it. But again, it's also quite a good port of knowledge for picking up on if jobs have come up that you haven't seen or things like that. One of the good things that did come as well was... there's a company in Belfast based at the Aldergrove, the Belfast International, doing medevac flights. And the aircraft that they use, so without going into too much detail, you've got aircraft that are authorised for single pilot operations. However, because it was medevac flights, to give the patients and, you know, people in the back a little bit of kind of reassurance and confidence, they would use qualified pilots, but not necessarily legally rated to fly those aircraft. And it's all legal and above board, and they call them pilot's assistants. So I had like a multi-engine piston rating, and it was a multi-engine piston aircraft that I was a pilot's assistant in. So I was there, and if the proverbial had hit the fan, I would have been capable enough of landing the aircraft with a bit of guidance. However, you know, on paper, it wasn't a legal, that's not the right word, but it wasn't, I couldn't have flown that aircraft on my own, but I could be there as an assistant. So I got a bit of work with them. It was unpaid. It was on a call basis. Sometimes I get a call 7-8 at night saying, can you come in at 5 in the morning? We've got a flight to Oxford. So it was really good. Now, the downside of that is, under the certain rules of CAA at the time, was I couldn't log any of those flights. So what we was doing was well above board, but I couldn't put it down on paper that as actual experience. So although I could include it in the CV, have had experience as a pilot's assistant, in the logbook, you couldn't actually put those hours down. So it was good experience, good fun. But, you know, it didn't really lead to anything. And I don't think that it played a part in... Really, because it was so long ago, I don't think it played any part in me getting the job with Logan Air in the end. But again, I put it down to experience, good fun.
Just for Dave's benefit with this, so you come out of flying school, right, and you've got your shiny new license, but everything's got validity dates. So certain things run out in 6 months, certain things run out in 12 months, certain things run out after 5 years. So you've really got to be, with the job hunt especially, you come out, you start searching for jobs, and at the beginning it's fine because your license is nice and fresh. But then after a few months, you start thinking, right, I'm going to be in a bit of trouble here, because if I don't get a job in the next X amount of time, then I'm going to have to start paying myself to keep everything current. Mm. And Mike, I think you ended up eventually doing that for 10 years, didn't you?
Yeah, nine years. I qualified June 2010 was my official qualification date. I got my license issued 3 weeks later than the July. And then I started with Logan Air on the 1st of July 2019. So it was essentially a month short of 9 years from getting the license in my hand, wow, to then starting a job where I was being paid to be a pilot.
Wow. I mean, it would be remiss of us here, Ben, whilst we're talking about websites, not to mention pilotbase.com, but we'll just...
Very good plug, Dave. I thought you weren't very good at the business stuff.
We'll just leave that in the ether. And if people who are listening decide to go onto whatever browser they use and type in pilotbase.com, then I think that'd be a great thing to do. 9 years is a long time. And we'll talk about what's happened since you've got the Loganair job shortly. But in that 9 years, what did you do to sort of keep the lights on? And did you ever think, oh, do you know what, the piloting, it's something that I dreamed of, but I'm just going to have to put it in a box and think about a different career?
Yeah, so just to start with the latter point, that happened several times. Okay. You know, you look at the there's a yearly cost against keeping, well, I suppose legal. Legal and current is completely different. Legal is you've got a paper, bit of paper that says that you can essentially fly an aircraft. Current is flying as much as you can to keep that hand-eye coordination in. Mm. So initially for me, it was a case of under the rules of like cost sharing, for example, my plan was to, I joined the local flying club in Newton Ards, you would get a couple of months of where I would get a flight a month to keep up with. So a flying club got legal, got rules along with their insurance as well. So you need to fly a certain amount of time, per month or per X amount of days to keep their insurance. And if you don't, you then have to fly with an instructor. And if you do that, it's more expensive. So you're always trying to chase that days to make sure that you get inside those. So each year, as Ben was saying, you've got to then go back and do a proficiency check. And the way that works with your multi-engine, so you've got like, to essentially get a job in airlines, you need a multi-engine instrument rating. And the instrument rating has to be redone every year. So the first year you can do it in the simulator, the second year it has to be done in the aircraft, and then you can alternate from there. So it does make it a little bit cheaper that first year because it's far cheaper to fly in a simulator than it is the actual aircraft. So the first year I went back to Bristol, and towards the end of the second year, again, it was getting to the point where you're starting to lose a bit of faith and a bit of hope. Then there was a friend of mine who we'd met through Bristol Aviation. He was using a company in Spain. And it was like, well, and then people say, why do you go to Spain? Why not do it in the UK? So it's all the same license. It's all the same regulator. However, the weather's a bit more guaranteed. So you essentially go in there. It's cheaper. Between the cost of fuel, the aircraft there. And it's also, my wife's not listening, it's also a chance to get away with the lads for the weekend. to somewhere like Madrid. you're looking at Madrid or Bristol. It's not. But even with the travel, it was cheaper going to Madrid than it was somewhere like Bristol or. So the first 2 years, everything was done, I'm on this, I'm going to do it. And at the end of the second year, I think was probably the first Teddy's out of the cot. It's not happening for me. I'm giving up, I'm in a good job. I'm working offshore. I'm in good money type thing, so why let it, why bother type thing? Like you say, you get to that point where, it's not happening. So that was that. And then at some point, you get that bug again, and the part of the license that I'd let lapse was purely just for the bit that I needed ticked to get commercial flying job. I could still fly the Cessna, the single engine for pleasure, because it's the validity of that to a specific rating is 2 years instead of 1 year. So the idea was to still continue doing that. I thought I had the income to keep it going as just an expensive hobby rather than a long-term kind of career thing. So that was the kind of mindset I had there. And then again, something happened. I had a friend in Eastern Airways who said, right, well, Eastern Airways is recruiting. They're in Aberdeen. Give them a shout. So I did. I gave Eastern Airways a shout. We'll get you in for an interview. Can you come this time? And I'm saying, well, I'm offshore, but I'm flexible. This date's... And it goes from that to, well, we were only squeezing you into a slot that had been cancelled as a favour to this guy that I knew. And it's just like, really, you know, is it really this hard to get a job in an industry that's on the pickup?
But I know what you mean. I've been to loads of airline interviews in my life, and some of them you just get a better feeling than others that you would fit in with the company ethos and the, you know, just the way everything feels.
Yeah,
you could have the exact same interview, but you just feel more comfortable and more at home in one than the other.
Definitely. And that would be a way of, yeah, that would definitely be a way of describing Logan Air. It's the general atmosphere. You know, you got easily pleased. We got sandwiches. <You know>? That's me. I was sold. If you get the sandwiches, I was sold. You know, but again, Logan Air has got a lot of ex-RAF guys as well in the engineering side. And actually, out of the 30 minutes we were chatting, probably 10-15 minutes of my 30 minute, I say, interview chat, was talking about my time in the RAF and being offshore. And the HR director was, I think he said that they joked at that Dundee, the base of Dundee for Logan Air, was they joked about being RAF Dundee because the 90% of the engineers for Logan Air were all ex-RAF guys. So they know what they're getting. You know, that generally, military in general are guys who understand and respect authority, but they've also got that confidence to speak up where things maybe aren't correct. They've got the discipline to turn into work every day on time. They're planning. Their preparation is always, I say always, generally most of the time, they know what they're getting. So I think without a doubt, my RAF experience, although it wasn't flying, just the fact that I'd been in the RAF played a big part. You know, there was definitely that, definitely gave a positive spin to the recruiters and getting, you know, and taking me in that day. Like,
the way you've spoken about Logan Air, it sounds like you've got a great affection for them. With all the sort of places you've visited and the near misses you've had and the mistakes you've made, does it feel like Logan Air is a great fit and probably even the best fit for you as a pilot, as a professional?
Without going into too much detail, recently there's been certain things that maybe could have done better, but okay. that's due to circumstance of what's going on in the world. At the end of the day, we're in these times and nobody could have planned, or there's no manual on how to deal with it. So that's kind of things that can be forgiven, depending on how things go forward. But 100%, from the day I joined the company, 1st of July last year, we were in Glasgow. There were certain things that we did before we started our actual typewriting course. And we were in the office. I think we were getting, I remember it well, we were stood getting our high-vis vests for going up to the to do fire and smoke training in Aberdeen. And the MD, Jonathan Hinkles, walked through the office, walked past us and stopped and turned around and went, you must be the new intake of Embraer guys. And he stood and he spoke to us and he introduced himself, you know, asked who we were, what experience we had. And he says, as it happens, he says, there's a meeting room next door. I'm just going in with the aircrew manager to speak about our kind of forward plans. He says, you're more than welcome to come in, sit in and listen to what the company's planning in the future. And for me, to come from a big multinational service company in the oil and gas industry, where my own country manager didn't even know my name, he'd walk past me in the office and didn't acknowledge me, to have like the MD of the company to spend that time and not only introduce himself but ask about us and invite us into a meeting that he was just a way to have. From that day, it felt like everything was just the way it should have been. You know, the 9 years, the Cathay Pacific, the Aer Lingus, the Ryanair, was always like, that happened because this was coming and that's all prepared. It sounds so cliche saying that everything happens for a reason, but for me, that really was the perfect plan. You know, we were in a house in Keith that we didn't need to move from. There was no uprooting of the family, and it was really the dream job was coming. It was starting on a jet as well, which is the dream of, well, I think most pilots would say if they could get a start in any kind of jet, it's the dream of a first job. So yeah, it's very much an affection I've got with the company. It's Scotland's airline. I love wearing my tartan tie every day. there's some of the ones, and some of the English ones especially reluctantly wear the tartan tie because they have to. Again, some of them who actually love it as much as I do, you know, I think it's part of the recognition of walking through, and we don't go into big airports, so it's not such a big thing. But going through like Aberdeen, you've got Ryanair, you've got Lufthansa, you've got EasyJet, you've got British Airways, but you instantly recognise the Loganair brand. You've got the tartan tie, you've got the tartan tail on the aircraft, and it makes me a wee bit fuzzy knowing that I'm flying for them, and hopefully will be for years to come. Yeah, but. There's definitely an affection there. Yeah,
I love it. And just hearing you talk about all of the other things that kind of led to this point, with anything that you do, whether it's being a pilot or anything, you just want to be able to seize that one opportunity. You just want to be in a position to take it when it presents itself. And maybe if you hadn't have had all those other experiences and all of those other near misses, then you wouldn't have been able to grab this one when it came. Oh, I love it.
100%. Well, just going back to the Aer Lingus thing, one of the guys that I did the assessment with, the young guy who'd been fresh out of training, he eventually, it was quite a few months down the line, so it was fair play for making the decision, but he'd got a start with another airline, another regional airline, and Aer Lingus came and says, right, you know, we want you, will you start with us? So if I'd been in the same position as him and accepted Aer Lingus if I'd got it, he was 3 weeks into his type rating, and he hasn't flown since February.
Wow.
So now he's sitting... waiting. He's still employed on 50% salary in a big airline, but he doesn't know if he's getting taken back on or if he's going to be laid off, you know. So, and again, it's one of those things that everything happens for a reason. Although the flying has been vastly reduced for even Loganair, we've kept going throughout the whole, you know, 7-8 months of the crisis, pandemic, whichever overly used word at the minute you want to use. But yeah, so we've managed to keep going, and as I say, the company have done, I believe, especially in the early parts of it, have done very well to kind of keep everybody as much as they could in jobs and current flying as much as they can, you know. So
I'm very aware that we've been speaking for a long time here, so we really appreciate your time, and I won't keep you for too much longer. But because of the affection that you've talked about, both the company that you work for and flying itself, not necessarily the process, but just try and give me a description of the feelings, of the emotions you get on a day where you're going to fly. So from arriving at the airport, walking through in your tartan tie, sitting on the tarmac in the cockpit and actually taking off, and the process of flying itself. How do you feel on a work day, on a flight day?
It's a mix of excitement and nerves. I think the nerves at the minute is primarily because you're not flying so often. So I'm still very, very early in my flying career in terms of not only time in months, but time as in hours flying. You know, for me, I had my issues even with Loganair during my training. I took two attempts to do what they call base training. I couldn't quite master the landing technique, which apparently is quite important for flying. So they say.
I'm just thinking for anybody who flies Loganair, when you're listening to this, if a voice comes over the Tannoy system and it's like, your pilot today is Mike Burgess, just strap in when it comes to that.
Yeah, just if you've got a cushion, stick it under yourself to soften the blow. But it just shows you, and again, just going off topic a minute, it just shows the reason I've got that affection for Loganair, because they never made a point of saying, you're under pressure to pass here or you're going to be out in your ear. You know, there was, we'll work with you. I got a bit of extra time in the sim. So going through that, so that's where the nerves come from, is that making sure, you know, I just want to get away from there was a bit of a kind of stigma for myself, think that people are going to think I'm 2 times Mike, because I took 2 times to do my base training. I took a second attempt on my line check because I have a minor issue at the very end of the flight. But again, the second time I did it, everything was on point where it should have been. Since then, the progression in the sim checks, I've had 2 sim checks, I've had 2 line checks, and they've all been signed off as being at least company standard or better, even the last one being in the very good range. So for me, I can see that progression, but the element of nerves, because of the lack of flying, I still want to make sure that everything is as it should be and perfect. The excitement, you know, every day I'm going to work is with excitement. You know, previous jobs, I would have given it my best, but if I started work at 6, I'd have been there at 5 to 6. Mm. Whereas now it's like you have to kind of weigh in the legalities of time, you know, duty time. So you can't arrive too early. But for me, it's, I'm going to be in there and my paperwork's going to be done so that everything I can focus on getting set up correctly. You know, we can do our briefing before we get to aircraft and I've got enough time that I'm not rushing. So everything's done as it should be. But even the early reports that we had reports where I'd be, I'm right on the cusp of our report time of 60 minutes. So on an early report, I'd be leaving the house at 4:30 in the morning, be getting up at 3:45, and the alarm goes off. I'm up, I'm in the shower, and I'm thinking, I'm going to fly a plane, you know, and it's that excitement every day that I go to work. So you go to work, you print out your paperwork, you can have a look, and there's always an element of, you hope the weather's nice. But sometimes you get that hope of, I hope there's a little bit of kind of choppiness today, because it's going to, you know, it kind of almost puts in the...
Adds a bit of spiciness.
The challenge. Reminds you that you've got the skills.
Yeah, and because Logan, I really do encourage a lot more manual hand flying. You know that you're actually going to get a feel of the aircraft and, you know, the excitement of actually flying an aircraft as opposed to these kind of big fancy jumbo jets where you just press buttons all the way down.
Yeah, like these A380s, these lazy...
Yeah, those guys don't know how to hand fly a plane anymore.
Yeah, boring.
We all know the aircraft can fly better than we can.
But, yeah, so the thing that I find at the minute, and I still, even as recent as my last flight... When you're sitting on the end of the runway, that's the first time you really get to control, because the captain does all the taxiing. You know, I start the engines. I think, I don't know if that's a common thing throughout all airlines, but it's the first officer who starts the engines. And then the captain, you do your checks, you taxi at the end of the runway. And if it's my flying sector, the words, you have control, it just gives you that kind of goosebump feeling, you know, the hairs in the back of your neck stand on end. And it's when you've got the thrust levers in your hand and you're advancing forward and you kind of feel it spooling up. And then again, I don't know if Ben feels this because it's so big, it's like a little slow crawl to start with. Whereas in the smaller aircraft, we've got 2 variants. We've got the 135, which is a 37 seater, so it's a good bit shorter than the 145, but it's got the same engines. So when you're in a 135, especially at the minute with the loads that we're getting, you know, you're getting less than half aircraft full. You kind of feel that power behind you. You know, you've got that thrust behind you.
And it's like a rocket ship, isn't it? When it's half,
it is. Yeah, you can be climbing at 6,500 feet per minute, in the 135 when it's empty, and that's doing it without any kind of struggle. You know, you're maintaining all your parameters that you need to be, and you're just going up, you know, like this, and it's that. Excitement. It's still exciting for me. And I know, as I said, I'm still very, very early into my flying career. And you fly with the odd captain who's been flying 10, 15 years, and they're like, oh, you know, I can't wait to retire. And I really, really hope that I never get to that point, because for me, regardless of where you are in your career, you know, you're flying an aircraft. You're getting paid to do what most people would only ever dream of doing without being paid for it, you know. So it's, it's just that I still get that kind of, and I get excited when I'm talking about it as well, you know.
I can tell it's amazing.
You know, but when you're kind of talking to people about it, and they say, oh, it's so cool. And, you know, it's the same, as being vegan. You know there's a pilot in the room because he's going to tell you. And I have absolutely no qualms about that. You know, I'm so proud and enthusiastic about the fact that I'm a pilot. And sometimes I kind of talk about it and I think, oh, I hope I'm not coming across as bullshit and arrogant, because it's not, I don't see it as being, I never look down on other people's in positions or what they do, but I'm very proud of the fact that, you know, I'm a pilot, the journey it's taken me to get here.
You do need to stop wearing a uniform to dinner parties, though.
Vicky told me I need to stop wearing them at school when I'm doing school drop-off, because you're getting, she's like, oh, you're wearing the, you know, the officer and a gentleman turning up and all the mums looking at
Is the hat really necessary?
Oh, goodness me.
But it is. And sometimes, you know, especially at the minute, I'm not flying, but I've been doing Project Wingman. I'm in my uniform and I don't hide it. You know, I'm in no way, well, probably more so now because it's cold. you know, so I've got the jacket over the top. But I do draw short of wearing the blazer. You know, I don't wear the full blazer out and about. You know, I wear the kind of shirt and tie and the epaulets, but a lot of it, especially now with the cold, right? So I wear a jacket over the top. But yeah, it was in the summer months. It was like, no, I'm proud of this. I'm going to the school gates with the
good man,
the uniform show.
Good man.
Mike, do you have time to talk about Project Wingman briefly?
Yeah, of course. Vicky's here. You know, there's no rush. Yeah.
So just for Dave's benefit, Project Wingman.
You say just for Dave's benefit. I'd like to hope that there are some people listening to this podcast who also don't have a Scooby what Project Wingman is.
Project Wingman is an excellent initiative set up at the beginning of coronavirus pandemic by some airline pilots, right? Is that right, yeah. Dave? Mike?
I don't know if you've ever seen the EasyJet program. I can't remember what it was called, but it basically covered the kind of transition of some of the cadet pilots through their base training into line training and beyond. And there was a particular captain, Emma Henderson, who was one of the main, I say characters, but obviously, you know, they were covering what she was doing as a job. And between her and another captain from BA, when the pandemic hit and they seen there was all these cabin crew pilots either furloughed, even laid off as early as, you know, back in the early stages, who, in the way that she puts it, it's a specific skill of dealing with the public, you know, the empathy, the professionalism. And what they initially set out to do was just set up a couple of lounges in a couple of the most busiest London hospitals, because she was based in Gatwick and I assume the other captain was based in Heathrow. And it started off as they wanted to set up a couple of these lounges where they would serve all the NHS staff on their breaks, tea and coffee, a few snacks that they would hope to be donated. It essentially just give the staff somewhere to go and kind of, relaxed, wind down a little bit between their breaks, and even just to talk about something other than the horrors that they were seeing in the hospitals with these guys, you know, with all these patients and people coming in who were, well, as we know, were dying and so on. And from there, word got around. So there was parts of the trusts that they were in were saying, well, we've got a hospital here. Would you like to come here? Would you like to come here? And of course, other trusts found out, would you like to come here? And Emma is actually, she lives in Kinloss, which is where the flying club is. Her husband is, I think he's ex-Air Force, but back working as a civilian in the base there.
Don't tell us too much about Emma.
Oh, okay. So Emma will tell you all about herself on other episodes. what she has done. So the actual project itself and where I get involved is, It basically exploded throughout the UK. So there's, from start to now, there's been over 80 lounges have opened. Some of them have now shut because things calmed down and certain hospitals needed either the space back or didn't feel it was a necessity anymore. So originally, because of where I live, I'm pretty much slap bang in the middle of Aberdeen and Inverness. I put on the website that I was interested and I'd be happy to travel to Aberdeen on an occasion to volunteer in there. So unexpectedly, when Dr. Grace came up, which is in Elgin, it's only 20 minutes along the road. Obviously, I got straight in there. You know, I was furloughed from basically from the 23rd of March. I think I flew my last flight up until the start of May. I had a few flights in May, but not very many. So even though I was back doing a little bit of flying, I still felt there was plenty of time to go and volunteer a few days a week in at Elgin. And it was the reception of it was just, it was amazing. You know, the staff would come in and say, you know, we don't feel we deserve this. Especially in Elgin, where it was a designated, what they were saying, I think they used the term designated clean. So if they got somebody that was already positive coming to Elgin, they would basically push them out to Aberdeen and Inverness because they were trying to maintain Elgin as a kind of more local hospital for emergencies to maintain that service. So some of the staff in there were saying that they're really quiet. You know, we don't deserve this. You know, we're coming in here. And it was great because they would come in and they would ask about your work and what you did. And they were interested in finding out more about you. And for me personally, I got myself in a bit of a rut. You know, I was sitting. I had no purpose. I had nothing to get up for in the morning. And that sounds quite extreme because, you know, Vicky and the kids, it was hard homeschooling. And it was really quite a change for me because I would get up. I wouldn't even shower. You know, I would sit on the sofa. I would get the kids sorted. We'd do a little bit of schoolwork. And then it would almost be left up to our eldest daughter to entertain the youngest one. And I would be sitting glued to the TV, obsessed with numbers and, oh, look at the death rate today and, you know, watching the updates and the news and on my phone. And it just, I'm quite bad on my phone anyway, but I was just constantly glued to my phone. My wife's a nurse. So because of the kind of line of work she was in, she was getting into occupational health work and all that was removed. So she continued with some of the agencies that she was on and she was working night shifts. So at night, I would be sitting on my own, watching TV, on my phone, looking at all the numbers and the facts and figures and all the kind of conspiracy theories. And of course, I'd go to bed, whatever time, midnight, half one, whatever time I can either woke up from dozing on the sofa or decided that I'd had enough of watching, you know, whatever. And then I'd kind of wake up when the wife came in the morning. We'd see each other for maybe an hour or so. She'd obviously want to spend time with the kids and go to bed. And it would just be like, oh, it's just Groundhog Day, every day. So when Project Wingman got going, you know, I threw myself into it. I was in 2 or 3 days a week, full shifts. And there was an element of, am I being selfish here? Because obviously Vicky was working. She was working a lot of night shifts and she was driving long hours. And then I was essentially... Our eldest said, well, she's just turned 16, so we knew that we could kind of leave them in the house themselves. Well, Vicky would be upstairs sleeping, but we knew that there was an element of they could kind of entertain themselves. But again, it was putting a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of our eldest daughter, which, you know, she, to be fair, she took like a champ. You know, she was, they were really good and helped each other out and so on. So in one respect, I really did feel the benefit of it. And as it went on, I kind of reduced the days a little bit and I tried to kind of coincide them so that I wasn't taking time away from, you know, from me and Vicky and the kids. So, yeah, it's been a massive thing and I've continued on. We've reduced the days a little bit because of, as the hospital gets back to a little bit of normality, there's less people coming in because they're busier doing their kind of normal day job and thing. Donations from companies have kind of, I wouldn't say they've dried up because we've still got enough to keep us going. But again, as our people get back to work as well, some of the volunteers are back to work. Some of them have lost jobs, gained jobs in other sectors, you know, so they can't volunteer anymore. But it's still going. And depending, obviously, I'm sure Emma's going to cover this as well, but just to kind of get it out there as well, what Wingman is doing now is they've set up a Wingman Wheels Foundation. And what that is basically the initiative to, they're buying a double-decker bus. It's being made out inside. They're having a big canopy that opens up on the side with fencing that goes around. And what they're going to do is they're going to drive the length and breadth of the UK. And the plan is at the minute they've got a year that they're aiming to raise enough money to keep them going for at least a full year, which includes the initial purchase and fit out of this bus. And what they'll do is each area that they're going to will call upon their volunteers from that area to see if they can cover a kind of 2 or 3 day period and do what they're calling these pop-up lounges. You know, so from starting off as a thought process of, and again, Emma will go into more detail about a few lounges in London, it's gone from that to over 5,500 volunteers that they've got available on their database scattered throughout the whole of the UK, including Northern Ireland. You know, there's a lounge being set up there this week as we speak. And there's still new lounges being set up, you know, so it's very much a response to COVID, but in the hope that it will be a long-term thing to kind of show the appreciation to the NHS, what they do all year round, not just through COVID. It obviously has been in response to COVID, but I think they're very much the long-term plan is it will be an ongoing thing.
People helping people. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, yeah.
Do you know what? I feel as though if we were going to continue this conversation, I wonder if this kind of side of you where you've realised that you've got help from it but also had a great amount from helping people, I wonder why that's one of the reasons why you want to be an airline pilot, because that is the sort of helping people get to where they need to be and all of that. But that is a deep psychological dive, so I'm going to put a pin in that right now.
It is a definite kind of connecting people with other people. But I think the main aspect of it is, and I think the biggest loss, if the way that things go now, if it was to end prematurely, I think who would feel the biggest loss is Vicky, my wife, because I wouldn't have that uniform to wear anymore. Obviously, she's an air shot.
Oh, my goodness me. Right. I think that is a great place to end this episode of the Pilot Base podcast. Mike, thank you so much for that. It's been great to, well, not just find out about your story, but sort of get exactly how much you love being a pilot and how much it means to you. It's great to hear. And I really hope that comes across to the listeners when they listen to it, because it's a hell of a story, mate. Thank you for sharing it with us.
No, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure. As I say, I enjoy talking about it. I'm enthusiastic when I talk about it. So hopefully that's come across as well.
Good man. Thank you.
Pleasure as always, mate. Thanks for listening to the Pilot Base podcast. We'll be back next week with another great guest from the aviation industry. Don't forget to check out our new career platform at pilotbase.com and all the socials at Pilot Base HQ. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe and write us a review.